Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories along with Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Russian President Vladimir Putin has criticized the United States for releasing a list of over 200 people with close ties to the Russian government. Putin described the release as a hostile and stupid move led by opponents of U.S. President Donald Trump. The U.S. Treasury Department published the list on Monday as required under a law approved by Congress. Lawmakers who voted for the measure wanted to punish Russia for interfering in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Some Russians worried that the publication of the list would lead to additional U.S. actions or restrictions from the global financial system. But the publication does not include any new sanctions. In a written statement, a State Department official said, just the threat of sanctions had already affected Russian companies. She said that U.S. officials estimate other countries have canceled plans to buy several billion dollars worth of products from Russia's defense industry. Putin said his government is not going to take any immediate action to answer the U.S. list. And he said he did not expect the publication to have an effect. But the Russian leader also said he was surprised by the number and range of the government officials and business people who were listed. He said ordinary Russian citizens, employees, and entire industries are behind each of those people and companies. So all 146 million people have essentially been put on this list. What is the point of this? I don't understand. Putin also joked that he was offended he was not included. However, every other top Russian government official was, along with the chief executives of all major state-owned companies. The list shows that the U.S. sees the entire Russian government as enemies, a spokesperson for Putin told reporters on Tuesday. The chairman of the Russian Foreign Affairs Committee, Konstantin Kosachev, criticized the U.S. for harming relations between the countries. He said that the consequences will be toxic and undermine prospects for cooperation for years ahead. Kosachev said the list shows U.S. lawmakers' political paranoia. But Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny praised the list. Navalny is known for investigating what he calls close ties between government officials and some of the billionaires on the list. The opposition leader wrote on social media that he was glad that these people have been officially recognized on the international level as crooks and thieves. Last August, President Trump reluctantly agreed to sign a bill aimed to take measures against groups doing significant business with people linked to Russia's defense and intelligence agencies. Trump said at the time that the bill improperly limited the president's power. He said the measures also hurt American companies and the interests of America's allies in Europe. Some U.S. lawmakers said they were disappointed President Trump had chosen not to punish anyone. Among them is Steny Hoyer, a top Democratic lawmaker in the House of Representatives. Hoyer said he did not believe the Trump government had put forth a plan for how it plans to deter further Russian aggression.
This is what's trending today. The moon is providing a rare triple treat this week. On Wednesday, much of the world will get to see not only a blue moon and a supermoon, but also a total lunar eclipse. Having all three events taking place at the same time is extremely unusual. Astronomers say this has not happened since 1982, and it won't happen again until 2037. A total lunar eclipse happens when the Earth comes between the Sun and a full moon. The eclipse will be easiest to see in the western half of the United States and Canada before the moon sets early Wednesday morning. It will also be visible across the Pacific Ocean into East Asia as the moon rises Wednesday night into Thursday. A blue moon is a second full moon in 1 month. A supermoon is a full or new moon. It appears brighter and bigger than usual because the moon is closer to the Earth than usual. In a total lunar eclipse, the Earth covers the moon's surface with its shadow, giving it a red-like color. For that reason, it is also known as a blood moon. Some people are calling this week's lunar event a super blue blood moon. Noah Petro is a scientist with the American Space Agency, NASA. He is calling the lunar event the Super Bowl of moons. And that's what's trending today.
Many people in Puerto Rico, a United States territory, are still suffering the effects of two powerful hurricanes that hit the island last year. Hurricane Irma struck in early September, followed shortly thereafter by Hurricane Maria. The back-to-back storms left at least 64 people dead and caused widespread destruction. Officials in Puerto Rico estimate the storms caused up to $95 billion in damage. Electricity was knocked out across the island. About 45% of power customers remain in the dark. Water and sewer systems were also badly damaged, causing shortages of drinking water and increasing risks of disease. Even before the latest hurricanes, Puerto Rico struggled for years with a major recession and financial problems. Much of the U.S. territory's infrastructure has long needed repairs. As efforts to rebuild from the storms continue, some organizations believe the disaster recovery operation can lead to some positive changes. One such organization is Ciencia Puerto Rico. The group describes itself as a global community of scientists, students, educators, and allies. Specifically, Ciencia has been working for more than 10 years to expand and improve science education in Puerto Rico. The group says Puerto Rico's science education system was failing long before the hurricanes hit. The territory's Department of Education reported that in 2016, only 40% of 8th grade public school students were considered proficient in science. Internationally, Puerto Rico schoolchildren are among the 10 worst performers on science tests. Ciencia says an estimated 98% of students are not able to use basic scientific knowledge to process data and handle complex problems. Students have also shown low performance levels in mathematics. Monica Falehu-Moher is the Director of Communications and Science Outreach for Ciencia Puerto Rico. She says the lack of science education in Puerto Rico goes back many years.
I was born and raised in Puerto Rico, and I remember growing up, I didn't know that science was done. I didn't know any Puerto Rican scientists. I never saw them in the media. So from the beginning of the organization, we set out to change that.
She added that while some students do show an interest in science and may want to learn more, most ignore these feelings. Students do not relate science to their daily lives and also do not see the studies as a realistic path to a future job, she said. But her organization is seeking to change that.
Science does belong in Puerto Rico, and Puerto Ricans do belong in science. And something that's always been really important for us is to make science relevant to the culture.
The organization sees the current situation as a historic chance to establish an educational connection between science and disasters.
There's so many big issues where science could play a role, from the environment to rebuilding to economic development. Science can be a key element for the recovery and for the rebuilding in Puerto Rico.
Over the next year, Ciencia plans to help connect scientists with community leaders and educators to find the best ways to teach disaster-related subjects.
We want these projects to be led by the students for their communities, so that the students can say, all right, here I am learning about water and water systems. How can I come up with a solution that's actually going to impact my community, which maybe has not had access to potable water for 3 months?
Lessons will also be developed about other disaster-related issues linked to the environment. Falehu-Moher added that using hands-on methods, instead of students just memorizing scientific facts, will cause more students to become interested in science. She says most schools have now reopened across Puerto Rico, but many are still operating without power and other basic necessities. This has made the learning process more difficult for students, many of whom also face the same conditions at home. One of the immediate goals has been to do as much as possible to allow schoolchildren to keep learning despite the difficult conditions. Moving forward, Ciencia believes the disaster can help launch a nationwide rebuilding of science education. While the group's main goal is to provide better overall science education, Falehu-Moher says the process will also provide students other valuable life skills.
It's not just about, can we get more Puerto Rican kids interested in science, but really it's about empowering people with the critical thinking that science can give you.
I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember in Washington. James K. Polk moved into the White House after his swearing in as the nation's 11th president on March 4, 1845. Polk told voters during the election campaign he would serve only one term as president. During those 4 years, he wanted to achieve or reach 4 main goals. 2 of his goals related to money. Polk wanted to reduce taxes on imports and to establish an independent treasury. His other goals related to expanding the country to the Pacific Ocean. President Polk wanted to secure the Oregon Territory and California for the United States. Those who supported the president shared Polk's belief that the United States should extend from sea to sea, from the Atlantic to the Pacific. They felt it was God's will and their duty to spread American democracy and freedom across the continent. In the words of poet Walt Whitman, "It is for the interest of mankind that America's power and territory should be extended. The farther, the better." One way Americans wanted to extend the country was by making the Oregon Territory part of the United States. The territory included what are now the U.S. states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, as well as part of the Canadian province of British Columbia. American traders established claims to the Oregon Territory early in the country's history. But British explorers gave Britain claims to the same territory. The two countries could not agree on how to divide Oregon between them. Since few white settlers lived in Oregon, Britain and the United States agreed to occupy the area jointly. This joint occupation worked well until the 1840s. Then, thousands of Americans began moving west to Oregon. The new settlers wanted all of Oregon to belong to the United States. President Polk agreed. He thought the United States had strong claims to the entire territory, but he said he would compromise. He offered to divide Oregon at the 49th parallel of latitude. Everything north of this line would belong to Britain. Everything south of it, including the Columbia River, would belong to the United States. Britain's minister in Washington rejected the offer. He said Britain would accept nothing but the Columbia River as the southern border of British Oregon. President Polk said America had no choice then but to claim all of Oregon. He seemed to say the United States would fight, if necessary, to defend its claim. Polk did not really want war, but he thought he needed a strong position to negotiate with Britain. In London, the British government decided Oregon was not worth a war with the United States. After all, Britain had moved its trading center on the Columbia River north to Vancouver Island, so there was no real reason to demand rights to the use of the river. The British foreign minister proposed a treaty that would divide the territory at the 49th parallel of latitude. The proposal was almost the same that President Polk had made earlier. The United States accepted the proposal. The treaty made the 49th parallel the U.S. border from the Rocky Mountains to the Pacific Ocean. South of this was California. An American government minister once described California as the richest, the most beautiful, and the healthiest country in the world. The official said the port of San Francisco was big enough to hold all the navies of the world. He said someday San Francisco would control the trade of all the Pacific Ocean. There was only one problem.
It was owned by Mexico.
Historian Robert Mary wrote a book about James K. Polk. Mr. Mary says Polk wanted to bring California into the Union anyway.
So obviously he had some underlying ideas about how that might be done.
At first, the United States attempted to buy California from the Mexican government. But Mexican officials refused even to talk about selling California to the United States. When the U.S. Congress approved statehood for Texas in early 1845, Mexico broke relations with the United States altogether. President Polk ordered the commander of the U.S. Army in Texas, Zachary Taylor, to move his forces into the disputed area near the Rio Grande River. The river formed part of the border between Texas and Mexico. Polk sent a representative to Mexico in an effort to reestablish diplomatic relations. But the Mexican government refused to talk with the diplomat. General Taylor sent one of his officers across the Rio Grande to meet with Mexican officials. The Mexicans protested. They said the area across the river was Mexican territory. The movement of American troops there, they said, was an act of war. For almost a month, the Americans and the Mexicans kept their positions. Then, on April 25, 1846, General Taylor received word that a large Mexican force had crossed the border a few kilometers up the river. A small force of American soldiers went to investigate. They were attacked. All of the Americans were killed, wounded, or captured. General Taylor quickly sent a message to President Polk in Washington. It said war had begun. Taylor's message arrived at the White House on May 9th. A few days later, the president asked Congress to give him everything he needed to win the war and bring peace to the area. Some members of Congress did not want to declare war against Mexico. They believed the United States was responsible for the situation along the Rio Grande. They were outvoted. Later, Polk wrote, "We had not gone to war for conquest, but it was clear that in making peace, we would, if possible, get California and other parts of Mexico." Many Americans opposed what they called Mr. Polk's war. Whig Party members and anti-slavery abolitionists in northern states believed that slave owners and Southerners in Polk's administration had planned the war. They believed the South wanted to win Mexican territory for the purpose of spreading and strengthening slavery. The president was troubled by this opposition, but he did not think the war would last long. He thought the United States could quickly force Mexico to sell him the territory he wanted. So Polk secretly sent a representative to the former Mexican dictator, Antonio López de Santa Anna. Santa Anna was living in exile in Cuba. The representative said the United States wanted to buy California and some other Mexican territory. Santa Anna said he would agree to the sale if the United States would help him return to power. President Polk accepted the deal. He ordered the United States Navy to let the former dictator sail to the Mexican port of Veracruz. But once Santa Anna returned, he failed to honor his promises. He refused to end the war and sell California. Instead, Santa Anna organized an army to fight the United States. In 4 months, he built an army of 20,000 men. When General Taylor learned that Santa Anna was preparing to attack, he moved his forces to fight the Mexicans. Santa Anna sent a representative to meet with General Taylor. The representative said the Americans had 1 hour to surrender. Taylor's answer to Santa Anna was short. Tell him to go to hell. The battle between the United States and Santa Anna's army lasted 2 days. Losses were heavy on both sides. On the second night, the Mexican forces withdrew from the battlefield. Taylor had won. The victory strengthened Taylor's public image. He had already won the Battle of Monterrey, a major trading and transportation center in northeast Mexico. Other American forces also were victorious. General Winfield Scott captured the port of Veracruz and was ready to attack Mexico City. Commodore Robert Stockton invaded California and had raised the American flag over the territory. Stephen Kearny seized Santa Fe, the capital of New Mexico, without firing a shot. Still, the war was not over. President Polk's short war already had lasted for more than a year. Polk decided to send a special diplomatic representative to Mexico. He asked the diplomat to negotiate a peace treaty whenever Mexico wanted to stop fighting. A ceasefire was declared, but attempts to negotiate a peace treaty failed. Santa Anna used the time to prepare for more fighting. So General Scott ended the ceasefire. His men began their attack on Mexico City. The fighting lasted 1 week. Finally, the government of Mexico surrendered and Santa Anna left power. On February 2, 1848, the United States and Mexico signed a peace treaty. Mexico agreed to give up California and New Mexico, and Mexico would recognize the Rio Grande as the southern border of Texas. The war was officially over. But historian Robert Mary says President Polk suffered because of the conflict. The war with Mexico, Mary says,
ended up being a much longer war than he had anticipated and much more costly in terms of lives, in terms of money, and in terms of his political standing.
The war with Mexico also influenced the U.S. election in 1848. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.